doing the best I can. But when it's time to put cheese in, I hope you'll understand that I was born a scrambling man.
I was tempted to do backup on that, but the pipes weren't really ready for it.
My pipes aren't.
The Denver Omelets Brothers Band. You a big Allman Brothers fan?
I mean, I'm not a huge Allman Brothers fan, but I have an Allman Brothers record, and I like it. The one with the kid on the front, I think it has Ramblin' Man on it.
Eat a Peach, I believe, right? Or is that Brothers and Sisters?
That's
Brothers and Sisters, I think.
I'd have to bust it out. I can't recall. So Alan apparently won't be able to make it today. He went to go see 2001: A Space Odyssey last night for the late show. He's feeling kind of not really ready to do the show today, which is perfectly understandable. I really look forward to when 2001: A Space Odyssey plays in the theater. It's an incredible happening. If anybody ever gets the chance to see 2001: A Space Odyssey in the theater, they'll see that that's really the way to watch it.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I got a chance to see that about 6-7 months ago, and I was very lucky to discover that it was playing. I just was randomly looking through a little movie app I have on my smartphone, and it said 2001, playing in Evanston, one day only. And this was the day before, and I made the trek out there, and it was worth every single penny. Really, and they did the intermission proper, you know. Just to take in the whole experience was something else. It was a pretty massive screen, too, which was pretty excellent.
Cool. I wondered about, like, if you went to go see it in IMAX, if it would work the same way, because the Cinerama is definitely, like, the way that the picture is, I don't know if it would be compatible, really. But I was thinking that would be cool to see it in the IMAX.
Yeah, that would be... Can you imagine if they did some shitty 3D transfer of 2001?
They would start a riot.
But what is that ultimately a bad thing?
To do it, you mean to put it into 3D, going wearing 3D glasses into 2001? I would say that if they were going to do that, they should just have it so that you put your 3D glasses on for certain segments, like obviously the wormhole segment, Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite segment. It'd be cool to be like, put on your 3D glasses now, but you know.
Did you see that latest Tron movie that hit the theaters?
I did, and I actually saw it in 3D at the Castro Theater across from Amy's house. It was cool.
That was cool how they went in and out of the 3D.
Yeah, it was funny. I was showing a friend of mine, actually, who was on the show, but the recording didn't work out, Andreas. I was showing him a poster that I had done where I took the poster from Metatron, from Tron. That was a Freudian slip. From Tron, where he's shooting up the shaft of light and it's going up to Metatron's cube, and he was like, huh, it's so funny, like, people are like, oh yeah, I don't know, Tron was okay, or like, they don't get the meaning of Tron and what's being communicated. It's basically taking the go board and geometry and expressing a deeply rooted thing in our psyche, you know. It's a very meaningful film, both those films, actually, if you know what you're looking at, especially with the twin, his twin that just operates, it just runs, and it's all logic based. That's really that's the idea. Oh, Alan's here.
Guys,
hey,
hi. I had snot come into my mouth. I just like snorted. And I like, if I'm full of snot, was like, oh, Alan's here. Like, it was okay. That's It's more. I just woke up, and you probably did too, I imagine.
Oh no, I've been up. Oh no, I've been up.
How was the theater, Alan?
Fucking intense. Fucking intense.
Yeah,
I went on a bit of an odyssey.
A little bit of an odyssey.
Cool.
Hey, I was talking to Andras because I was really needed to talk to somebody to see where I was at. So I've been talking to Andras for a bit. He's got to go soon, but I was like, hey, do you want to join me? He's like, well, I got to go soon. I was like, why don't you come on for like half an hour? So can you add him to this call?
Adding Andras Jones now.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
Do you have any popcorn?
No.
No need for popcorn?
No. The only thing I've eaten in the past 16 hours is a lot of water, and I just got down a little smoothie.
Hello, Andras.
Hello.
Hey.
Always recording. Always recording.
Absolutely. How you been, buddy?
Very good. Very good. How are you?
I'm excellent. We got David and Alan here.
I hear that you've been inundated with intense reactions to your appearance on Red Ice.
I got a little spooked for a little minute. I think this is something that Alan has dealt with much more than I have. So I think my instincts kicked in on, I think, a normal level. But it was...
I think you did great, man. You did great.
I felt like I needed to tango a little bit with it, but I think I figured out when to just let it go. And I got some really good advice from some people, and I think I'm better for the experience. So I got out of it what I think I needed to get out of it. But yeah, for about 15 minutes there, I was detached. I was spiraling a little bit. When people start calling you a Zionist and a racist mongering... I don't know, just a lot of shit, man. And I was.
Yeah, what I didn't get was where in our Red Ice that you would even get out of that. Like he said, race hate, which I guess he's saying if you're a Zionist, you hate non-Zionists or something. Like, I don't know I don't even know what he meant by that, but he's like, you're preaching your Zionism and your race hate. And I'm like, wait a second, you're being anti-Semitic and you're saying we're preaching race? Like, I don't even get that, how you can have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah, and then to be accused of selling brainwashing and who's your superior, where are you based out of, like, that's hilarious to me. I love that.
Right.
I really want to just love that completely, but when there's no
right, when he asked who your CIA handler was,
yeah, when there's no hint at all of humor.
I didn't listen to the second half of your guys' thing. Is there something that I'm missing? Did you guys go into like the territories or something? Is there a reason? Is there any reason?
Yeah, and the whole second hour is us saying that Jews are the master race and that people need to sign up at their local CIA office. And you missed that?
Yeah, I missed that part.
I mean, it was a little subtler than that, but I think it's clearly implied.
Wow. That's kind of fun, though.
I'm laughing now.
But so I also found this experience. Like, I think what I found most difficult about it is, like, how do you – and this is what I've been kind of dealing with anyway, but, like, how do you deal with that paranoid chaos, like someone who's staring into the abyss and is spiraling out of control, and they can just as easily pull you into it. And
you're right, you're absolutely right.
And it's like
right.
When I was trying to feel like it felt like if I addressed the issues in what I would think would be an intelligent, rational way, I didn't think that was really going to go anywhere. He's just going to start yelling and going, you know, you're CIA, you're CIA. And it's like, that basically ends the conversation. Like, for a guy whose whole thing is about committing no fallacies, he sure does a lot of, you know, different appeal to authority and just sort of like straw man tactics and shit like that. you know, saying, trying to associate you as a CIA agent or a Zionist or whatever, and just hoping that that, you know, those loaded words get stuck to your persona and discredits your argument that way. These are major fallacies, are they not?
This was Jan Irving who is coming up.
So the question is, like, if you address that head on, I didn't really feel like it was going to go anywhere. And at the same time, like, the New Yorker in me is like, fuck you. I will fuck you up. Like, you really, this is where you want to go? Like, I will make sure that, like, you do not forget that you fucked with me. And, like, all these different things of, like, I went down these different roads. Like, well, what does that lead to? What is the point of doing that? Am I wasting my time? And I feel like he's craving desire. Like, he's craving attention. Why would you go out and just randomly attack fucking people on the internet? Either he's craving the attention, or he's in such a dark, paranoid headspace that it's just lashing out blindly at anything and everything. And it could be that it's both, you know? It's like, you know, you're kind of fucking... I'm sure that's a very lonely and horrible headspace to be in.
Yeah, I second that. And I think I started to get pulled into it, like you said, Alan. Like, there was something that kind of was attracted to the madness, just to see how deep and how dark it could go, and just to see how absurd the case he could build. Like, what in fantasy world does he think I am, or my, you know, my peers and my cohort are, and how large of a fucked up conspiracy could he build out of it?
Like, well, you can't build too much when you got, like, when you're like, don't want to, like, he'll insult people that study things. So, like, if you study Kabbalah and he has an opinion about Kabbalah, then how can you attack something that you don't know about? Like, that's what gets me. I'm like, you don't want to study something because it's bad to study, then how can you say what it is until you study it? Right. Like, that's the thing. I'm just like, very empirical.
do you know if that clip, when so if anyone's listening, for the record, the Jan Irvin Always Record interview is not the full Jan Irvin interview, and I don't think there's anything bad in saying that. But for the record, we always record, and sometimes if someone asks for something to be removed, we've removed small pieces. Jan actually went in and edited. He wouldn't allow us to put the interview without his own edit, so he chopped a lot out.
Like 18 minutes or something.
Yeah. It's, which is the fucking Watergate tapes. It's so funny. He doesn't even realize he cut out 18 minutes. You Richard Nixon fucking witch hunt bastard. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so he doesn't even realize that he's doing it. He's in a ritual.
Wait, what's on the 18 minutes?
Well, that's what I was just going to ask.
Shouting about me saying my rabbi, and I'm like, you know, I said my rabbi, and he's like, looks at it like this whole like club thing, and I'm like, no, like I approached somebody at their house because I was told that this is somebody you should talk to, and I sincerely said I would like to study this information, you know, and he was like, well, if you're serious about it and you're willing to, you know, go, you're for real, then we'll do it, you know, and we've been doing that for the last 6 years or so, and so you know, like, I don't know how but that really angered Jan.
This was right out the gate. Towards the very beginning of the show, like, we're just getting all talking, everyone's nice and friendly, and then David says something about, he goes, well, my rabbi said, and he's like, wait a second, you have a rabbi? And like, that was it.
And so,
like, I've never experienced something like that in my life.
And I'm not happy with, like, that's the worst conversation we've ever had. And it, because just being that it gets heated isn't reason enough to be like, oh, well, like, that's it. I don't even think it was an entertaining show. I don't even, you know, like, it was just a it wasn't a positive experience. It was totally like, and I'm like, we go deeper with information, and like, I said things that I you know, look up after the fact. I'm like, I said things that weren't true that I normally wouldn't. I was like under the pressure and trying to like, everything I said was like being so scrutinized and so intense that like I just.
But don't you realize that's what he felt? See, I'm in a weird space where I last night I understood Jan Ervin's headspace. It's a terrifying headspace, but I understood it. And the thing is that so like he's feeling also like he's being scrutinized. He keeps saying that he feels like we set him up for that interview, which I don't get how you feel that. But if you're being if you're feeling that pressure and you feel like everything.
Well, you safe, did say rabbi to him.
Right.
Maybe that's like the Manchurian candidate. Like that's the one word that unleashes the programming.
Slowly I turn, step by step.
So
just bit about the Niagara Falls.
What I want to ask is in the audio that was cut, do you know there was a segment where he said where we say something about Kabbalah and he goes, Kabbalah, I know about Kabbalah. It's like there's like a tree and a I know about Kabbalah. He goes, oh, hold on, I got some notes here. And that was like his reaction. And what I don't get is in the Facebook thread where he's publicly attacking us, he talks about some other guy, I don't know who, and he says, basically, Dave, what you just said, how do you talk about something that you obviously don't have familiarity with? And this is my question is, how does Jan Ervin have an opinion about Kabbalah without actually knowing anything about it? So number one, that seems highly ignorant. And then he can say, I'm using the trivium to show that it's something mystical and therefore it's automatically disqualified or blah, blah, blah. Hey, that's fine, whatever. But then to just to throw all these, lump all this other shit in with it. I made the point on Facebook. I said, if being into Kabbalah makes me a Zionist, then being into the I Ching must make me a communist. Being into right. Greco-Roman mythology must make me a Republican. Being into Hindu mythology must make me a supporter of the caste system. Like that, these don't work. Like that's not none of these things are true. Right. But that's the same kind of logic. And I sure. So I'm really upset. And this is why I was upset. And like was like we should go out and like we have. I think we can have a rational, fucking, intelligent conversation about this. Like, hey, obviously you're not thinking this through. And at the same time, isn't that basically what he's always screaming? You know, you're thinking improperly. So like I saw that getting into a debate like that is just like whose reality tunnel is more valid.
That's perfect. Yeah, absolutely.
And I clearly just, it's yours.
Well, of course.
I mean, otherwise why I mean and for him it's his.
Yeah, but, yeah.
I mean, I think that what we do here is we open up our reality tunnels, and on some level, you want to be supported in what you see and feel and think and read. But I'm also open to having large portions of that reality tunnel, destroyed, like to move forward, to grow, to move forward, and that was what the whole point of having Jan on was. To see if he could engage in an open-ended conversation. But it was a street fight. All that was a street fight. And once David said rabbi, he like jumped on him. And David did an admirable job of handling himself as a rational adult human being. And I just... And people can have different opinions of what they heard on that show, but from the first, if you hear the full tape, I mean, it's a little bit different.
Now, here's my question to anyone here. And this is, I mean this seriously, and this is not to like label somebody something or whatever, but I'm going to fucking put it on the table. Do you think, Bill, if you said something like being raised Catholic and you said, I went to my priest, do you think he would have jumped as strongly at a Christian guy saying, I went to a priest, as he did someone saying they went to a rabbi? Do you think it's like, I know this gets bandied about too much. I'm not trying to, but I'm going to call a spade. Like, is this just straight up anti-Semitism of like, hey, you said rabbi, I went crazy?
I don't think it is, because when the subject of guru came up, there was just as big of a reaction.
Yeah, I'm gonna agree with David. I think that he would say, "You're blind. You're not seeing things in a proper way. You're just a pawn, and you need to wake up. You have a priest, you have a rabbi, you have a guru. No, you should have the trivium. It seemingly boiled down to that.
Right. But, I mean, there's no way for me to show. If he had actually met my teacher and had seen, you know, that he's got around his space, he's got pictures of rabbis holding signs anti-Zionism. He's very anti-Zionist, and he's a rabbi. It's like, I think that that's like something that he just wouldn't assume would actually be the case. And so, like, you know, it didn't matter if I told him that. He's just like, well, that's, you know, what, you know.
It's, well, Alan, to your question, it's not necessarily, I wasn't there, but the way it's being described, it sounds like he has a problem with all teachers, but I don't think that if you said that you were going to your guru, he would call you a Zionist. It was the attack was anti-Semitic. It's to say that anyone who has anything to do with Jewish teachings is de facto a Zionist, which is to say a Jewish Nazi, basically. Is the sort of the code word, is sort of the coding that's there. And that particular coding and the tenor of that coding is either consciously or unconsciously anti-Semitic. Just like if you said, you know, that you were into hip hop music and then you started saying racist things to you. You know, saying that, oh, well, tell it to Brother Farrakhan. You know, right. It's like, so you've just made a huge leap that comes from racism.
Right. And even
so
like...
your point is not that, was it that he has a problem with all teachers, or was it anti-Semitic? You're saying, yes, it's both. Like, on one level, the tenor of it...
If someone calls me a Zionist because I reference something that has to do with Judaism, that is purely something that comes from their collapsing of a huge thing into a very small thing, which is the essence of racism and intolerance.
Right.
In an intellectual way, maybe, but so not being there, I don't know if it's like, well, he's Dirty Harry and he does, you know, like the Dirty Harry, he's like, I'm not racist, I hate everybody. You know, maybe he just hates everybody.
Yeah,
but
think it's more like that.
He seems a pretty hateful person.
But, you know, and just like Dirty Harry, you know, the way Dirty Harry fucks with a black guy is racist. And the way Dirty Harry fucks with a Mexican guy is racist. And we're supposed to, when we watch those movies, think, oh, it's funny because he hates everyone. It does it to everyone. But in reality, there's probably someone he doesn't attack. And those people are the people who he thinks are the good people. And the rest of us, be we Zionists or Papists or, you know, communists or whatever else you're going to attach to whatever collapsing you've done on these terms and these teachings, it shows that, yeah, that's a, you know, it is a kind of a racist. It's, yes, it's other things, but you can't deny that there is racism going on there. When someone, you know, I'm not racist, I just burned a cross on your lawn. You know, it's not because you're black. It's just because I like burning crosses, you know.
I just thought it was Halloween. I was wearing this sheet for...
when he starts calling other people besides Jews Zionists, or like when he starts calling the, you know, Catholics Zionists, and that's, he just calls everyone who he hates a Zionist, well, even then I'd still say that's kind of racist. Because it's like, not that I, you know, just, that's, it's not very confusing, but...
It's not a race either. That's a funny thing. I mean, I don't know. And that's kind of like what he was saying, is he's like, he's kind of presenting this idea that it's like just about all people who call themselves Jewish are like Russian converts. And it's like, yeah, a lot of people were converted to Judaism. And like, this is not the, like, I'm down. I have no problem with that. I mean, that'll offend some Jews, but it's the percentage of Jews that are actually Russian converts. I don't, it gets that. That's like a really like classic response to Judaism that like people like to present, but it's not
couldn't that
as it gets. What's
David,
that?
Couldn't that same argument be made against like post-Holy Roman Empire, like the idea of converting everyone to Christianity.
Oh,
like,
yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah.
So, like, it's a historical fact that at some point a bunch of people had their religions changed. Like, that's not rocket science. That's not rocket science.
Totally. Yeah. What I found really interesting was that when I was like, okay, well, I actually got excited in the conversation when he said he knows some things about Kabbalah. I was like, oh, we can go into this. And it became very clear very fast that it was all the European occultist angle, which is fine. Like, I've studied that too, but it's a different system. It's a different way of approaching the thing. And so I was like, okay, well, you're not talking about Judaism now, and you're not talking about Spanish Kabbalists. You're talking about Israel Regarde in Hollywood and his interpretation of something, which is just totally different. And so I'm like, well, then we're not talking about Kabbalah, really. I mean, you might want to spell it differently or something, you know, but make it with a Q. I don't know. <it's> just, I don't know. It's interesting. Or Madonna Kabbalah. He said a few things that came directly from Madonna's teacher. I don't know what they call it, the Kabbalah Center or whatever. And that's very different as well, you know? So that's not the point, though, I guess. It was just, did you guys see this interview Jan Irving exposed on our good friend?
Manufacturing the Deadhead?
I got to say, I'm spacing right now. What's our good friend in Australia's name?
Vinny Eastwood. But apparently Vinny Eastwood did that show, and then Jan Irving, you know, honestly, let's back up. For okay. real. I don't want to spend my morning, because then we can get to their drama and then however they came out of that drama. I want to take this back to the beginning. Like, Bill, you said, so here's my question. Do we want to address this, or is the thing to do, like, let that guy be crazy over there and we just keep doing good work here? Like, that's my question.
I think that what I found out through this experience is that all it is wasted energy.
Right.
And this is what a vampire does. And he's running out of fresh bodies to sink his teeth in. And if we're his latest target, then what, I mean, and this is, I don't know what this says about me, and I hope this doesn't offend anybody, but if we're his latest target to take down, then has he taken out all the big evil targets in the world? I mean, if he is of such a brilliant mind and he's got the trivium as this, you know, he's leveled up his trivium to, you know, the highest level it can be, why is he swinging that sword over at these sink dudes? I mean, we're clearly not connected to anybody other than the umbrella we've created ourselves. And that umbrella is, like I told him, in the sink books, it's 52 different voices. These are all different people with different interpretations and different experiences. This is not a united front or an agenda. And if he's out to destroy Zionist agendas, then he needs to turn his target site to a different target, because we're not the ones. We aren't the people he should be trying to destroy or to expose. There's nothing to expose here. We make ourselves exposed. That's the whole point of this thing. And
right, it's like we're standing out. We put ourselves out, fucking buck ass naked, hearts on our sleeves, doing this show, and then to be told we have a secret agenda.
It's laughable. It's silly. It's as if like my 5-year-old niece was attacking me. There's nothing there. There really is nothing there.
I thought you were going to say the other thing. It's just as if you were like, if he's that powerful, you know, it's sort of like even assuming that he was right, assuming he was totally right about you guys and us, you know, what's the listenership here?
Not much.
What's the reach of what you're doing? So if you're that powerful, us even assuming our agenda is as nefarious as he expects, why is he picking on the lamest ass, like, no offense to us, but aren't, you know, assuming that there's real evil in the world, shouldn't you be going after the ones who are actually
But you know, can I tell, this has been, so this was my experience with, when I was in New York, I had multiple times where I got stopped by the police while people were doing real crime within sight of me. And I would say to the police, I was like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, I'm like, one night I was going to meet Melissa at work, and it's like 3 a.m. I had to wait for like a really long, the trains were totally delayed. I'm just standing on this train platform, and these like group of like six guys drunk, smashing shit, like throwing garbage cans. And I'm like, all right, you know what? I'm going to go fucking walk over there. And then I went and I sat down on a step and started reading a book. And this cop comes up to me and gives me a ticket, takes me upstairs to run my ID. I had to leave the train station. I was with him for like 2 hours, him, you know, doing background checks on me to make sure I'm not this nasty criminal. And I'm saying to him, look, those guys are like destroying property right there. Like, they're actually committing crimes. I'm sitting here reading a book. What the fuck? And then I realized he was a fucking pussy. Like, he's not going to go actually tell those guys to stop because he might get hurt. But he's still going to make his quota. So yeah, he came and gave me the ticket. And this is exactly what it feels like. It's what, like, you went after the, sitting on the steps. It was obstructing the flow of traffic. Bear in mind, there's no one in the station. There was like, I'm sitting off on one side. It's a very wide staircase. This is like, these are staircases that take thousands of people up and down them all day. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting off in one corner. There was no obstruction. It wasn't like no one could get around me. Plenty of room. No any. I'm just sitting there reading a book. And and I had to go upstairs. He had to like take all my ID, radio, and I had to wait for them to do a background check on me to make sure I wasn't dangerous.
It's because, like, he saw you reading the Sync book and he thought it might be Zionist propaganda.
Right. But I really think it's because the cop was scared. He's not going to, you know, you could put on the badge and say you're going to fight for truth and justice and blah, blah, blah. But if you're going to, you know, if you're going to wear the badge of justice, you can't be that big a pussy. So, but I really think that's why we're being attacked. It's like, it's an easy target. It's like going after the fucking sick zebra in the jungle. Like, we're just getting started. Like, and then Doug's thing was like, maybe this means we've reached something. Like, maybe we're not as small as we think. I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, Alan, thank you for inviting me to jump on for just a little bit of the Always Report. I have to go study some Kabbalah. And
Zion and, forever, Andres.
So yeah, thank you. I am the Lion of Zion. And
hey, are we still on for Saturday for drinking baby's blood? And
I don't know. We'll have to call Dick Cheney, see if he can make it.
Yeah, I gotta talk to my handler. I can't, you know, I can't make a move without him.
Well, when you get word from headquarters, be sure to let us know. You can send us the message in veiled, quote unquote, synchro mystic symbols, telling us what to do. We await your next code word, Jew Master.
Shalom, my brothers. Shalom.
Goodbye.
Bye.
see if Dr. Claw can make it as well. He's been so unpredictable lately, you know.
Oh boy, that was a good laugh. All right, so a few questions. Bill, you actually ended up calling me earlier this week with, you got so excited about something. What was your major revelation?
Well, it just picking at a thread, my something seemed to lock into my brain that I thought either I've been missing this or I'm opening my eyes to it. And it's regarding a passage in a letter that Philip K. Dick wrote with his interpretation that Christ, you know, the Savior, was just a manifestation of Dionysus, right? that Dionysus, there was someone before him, it manifested as Dionysus, it manifested as Christ, and I was under this thread of thinking that JFK, being a Roman Catholic, was a emergent Dionysian slash Jesus type figure, and that the king kill had something to do with this division between Apollonian Christ figures, or Apollo as Christ, versus Dionysus as Christ. And that there's this sort of ping-pong match when whenever Dionysus gets enough power and emerges in an individual with that much public power, that the Apollo side naturally reacts to kill the king. And then once Apollo gets enough public power, the Dionysian will attack the Apollo king. And that this is sort of this loop that we're stuck in, of the Dionysian versus the Apollo, and how public opinion blindly feeds into this process. And I was picking your brain to see how you felt this factored into the book that you're writing.
Well, so as we've talked about many times, there's Nietzsche's idea is that you have essentially both appear in tandem, right? It's like one acts as a counterbalance to the other. It's sort of like the answer is yes. I hope this isn't too abstract, but the answer is yes. Is that so? It's like they're switched back and forth and they happen at the same time. It's sort of like, you know, if you know anything about economics, you have like your X and Y axis and you have supply and demand. But if then if you plot that over time, everything starts to change. You need a whole new model for introducing time. So it seems to me that if we want to get caught up on the idea of like, does it happen in tandem or is it a back and forth? It's sort of like your yin yang thing. Like, well, it's always kind of both happening, or it's always kind of in flux between the two, but it's definitely a cycle. And that's the more abstract answer. If we want to, or the thing that I'd sort of say, like, it seems like that's one aspect of it that I don't really think you can give a straight answer, or that it even matters, that pure semantics at that point. Is it a this, then this, then this, then this, then this, or is it just a constant pairing of the two? Regardless, it definitely would seem to me that when Dionysus would seem to me to be the embracing of the collective, embracing the other, right? This is getting drunk on Maya, illusion, the dark feminine, all these things that we can kind of say might be represented by the other. Whereas Apollo, the sun, this sort of like you taking that power for yourself. So do you want to be the king? Do you want to be like pure self, light in the pure self of your consciousness? But that's also a very lonely thing. So then you come back out of that and then go back into embracing the other. When you go fully embrace the other, then at some point you start rebelling back and saying, no, I want some of my individuality back. This is seems to me why we have a rise and fall of communism and socialism and, you know, libertarianism, people trying to like, right now I want to break free. Right now I think we need to get back together. Now we need to do this. It's like it's this weird lover's quarrel. I honestly think Mark LeClaire's chapter in the Sync book, you know, for all its, you know, I'm not taking it literally, or maybe in a sense I am, is the idea that this is this constant, like, can't live with him, can't live without him, you know, is like how we are with each other in this world. And to embrace the alchemical marriage, and it doesn't just have to be a woman. This can be in, you know, gay relationships or anything, because it could be UFOs or God or whatever. Like when you are embracing something other than yourself and accepting that and reveling in the ecstatic experience of being connected to someone else or everything else, as a lot of synchromystics do, the idea of fully embracing this moment and this world around you? Or do you want to go, you know, go back inside? And this to me seems what we kind of keep going back and forth against. And I ultimately don't know if it can exist any other way. Like, one of the things I realized last night was that this, you know, killing of the king is just like the most brutal, or in some sense obvious, any kind of murder or suicide is basically the most brutal manifestation of that. It's just a variation on that, but instead of like someone saying, you know, you have a girlfriend and you say, like, get into a fight and say, all right, we're done here, and someone storms out, or you spend a night sleeping on the couch, you have your moments of separation, and then you get back together. In the same way, this is like pulling away in the most, I guess the Holocaust is perhaps the most, but, you know, it's similar. It's like trying to retreat from that, break out of the illusion, break out of, you know, your connection to everything else and refind yourself. And it's a fairly obviously diluted version of that, and at the same time, for the person going through it, it's no less real. So even like a phrase like delusion is a sort of tricky one to say.
So Bill, when you brought this up to me, I think was it yesterday, day before. Anyways, it sent me on this whole. I really was kind of considering. It's kind of strange, but I was paralleling Dionysus and Apollo to the uppermost spherot of the seven lower sphera. So, like, I was considering, like, okay, so, you know, you have Chesed and Gevorah have this value of Gevorah is 216 and Chesed is 72. And you know that 72 times 3 is 216. Mm-hmm. And the 216 letter name that's acknowledged in Kabbalah, it's very like, it's you know, I guess you'd call it a big deal as far as names go. They derive from three verses in Exodus that occur side by side. So it's three verses. Each verse has 72 letters. And so they work with this in this kind of interesting way. So here, let me see if I can. They're taken as the dividing of the waters. So it parallels the firmament. So in Genesis, when the firmament is broken up and then you have something that can be born up out of it, is from the two sides splitting. And so from the split emerges growth. And so I was considering that these are the whole idea of the way that they relate to severity and mercy are the same way that we relate to Dionysus and Apollo. In fact, in the old system, you'd see them represented as the sun and the moon. Whereas in the European system, you see Yesodas taken as the moon. It used to be Chesed, and Gevorah was the sun. And so I was considering that, like, Apollo being like government, being like order. Mm-hmm. It's like you build a statue, that's Apollo. And so that can be on a they're all both on continuums in terms of expression. Like you can have, you know, and yeah, exactly. Like Apollo mission, it's a giant phallic rocket. Like our weapons are phallic, you know, all of them. Like that's like Apollo, right? And so I was also considering, like, even in the mythology of Apollo defeats the serpent, who is the serpent. The serpent could be taken as Dionysian, right? In the sense that it's the most you know, subtle of all the creatures in the garden. It slithers along. It's like it's anti-order, right? Because it's so fluid, and it's just, I don't know. I was like kind of contemplating this, but I didn't even
David,
realize.
Can I ask you, what do you, if you said Chesed is 72, what do you make of the fact that, say, like the Dakota is on 72nd Street? So here's another assassination. You have John Lennon being killed on 72nd Street at the Dakota. So here would almost seem to mark it as the spot of mercy. And yet, I guess I'm sort of, what do you make of that, if anything?
Well, I feel like kind of what we're looking at a set of dynamics that you want to apply after you understand the dynamics, and this is something that I don't completely, you know, I mean, I can appreciate it as soon as you start dealing with like opposites in general, but these are very particular in their expression, even though they are archetypal at the same time. And so with the 72nd Street thing, that sent me on a whole, because you told me that probably, I don't know, 5 months ago or something, and I've been kind of I've had that come up every so often. I mean, I don't know. I think it's interesting. It's like one exists in the other, and the other exists in what? It's like masculine and feminine principles, you know, in a sense. But it, I don't know. So this is really kind of weird that it didn't. I'm looking at this for a while, and it's not occurring to me that when you lay out the lightning flash down the tree, right, which is also a serpent. Coming the other way, supposedly, is how people take it, is that you're ascending the tree. That's like a sort of, but I don't know where they got that, if that's actually, if that's not just like a European thing. But isn't it interesting that the pathway between the 72 and the 216 is taken to be Tet by the Europeans, which is strength. So you have Oz is literally the connector between these two spheres, which I had been before that was occurring to me, relating to Dionysus and Apollo. It's kind of weird.
So the land of Oz is the pathway between Chesed and Gevurah?
Yeah, so you could look at it as a dweller on the threshold, in the sense that it's at the abyss, right? So like, before you go to the other side, what is there? And so I was also considering the idea, like, you know how in economics you have a black swan theory, so where there can be an event that just, you have something that you're working with, and the two sides, and things are in relative balance, and they shift to a degree, but if you bring in something to break the inertia, like, inertia is like something moving in a straight line, and nothing will deviate its course unless if it's acted upon by something outside of itself. And so I was considering that, like, that's the, like, the middle pillar, right? Or the pentagon, you know what I mean? Like, in the sense that you have the other factor, this third column or whatever. But that's like, you have these polars, and then something comes along that shifts it. Below that, where you have Netzach and Hod, you have the connector is the tower. And so it's like the thing, that's the factor of change. Like when you lay out the tarot tableau, you have the tower is opposite Gemini, so you have like the duality up on top of the twins, which you could look at as the brothers who established Rome, Romulus and Remus, right? And then below that you have the tower in direct conjunction, so you have this singular tower that collapses, which when seen through our perception expresses itself dualistically. Anyways,
right,
I don't know.
The single tower splits into the two towers. The two towers crumble and are rebuilt as the single tower.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's like, it's just going like, you know, basically flipping between these two, which is why I said it's like, it's definitely an on off strobe, if you will. And I think if you wanted to take this, just to go through some of the sinks might be fun is to say, you're saying the idea of being on the abyss struck me because in the actual Wizard of Oz book, they describe there is a land of Oz, and then at the borderlands is this like death zone. It is the abyss. Oz right. is surrounded by the abyss. Now you have right next to the Dakota, I mean, it's literally across the street from the entrance to Central Park. So you have this big green swath surrounded by city. So you have essentially the Emerald City in the center.
That's good.
Then Mark David Chapman says he was talking to the Munchkins from Oz. But what does he do? But he went out of bounds. He went into the abyss. He left the park, and now here he is in the abyss lands in the dead zone.
Yeah, or the forbidden zone in Planet of the Apes.
Yes, absolutely.
2001. So going to the outlands, right?
And to me, this is so, which is weird. Again, when you say it's like playing with opposites, because in a weird sort of way, Oz is the underworld. You know, it is the land down under. And at the same time, you're leaving it to go into the other realm. It's a very difficult thing to wrap your head around, but I think we're actually understanding each other pretty well.
Yeah, I was having an interesting thing too with like Iowas being Ion and Oz. So I don't know. I should actually look up and see if that translates anything, although my dictionaries are in the house.
If you want to say something like the Alpha and the Omega as being the totality of sort of conscious waking reality, then to finish off the alphabet, you have the Omega to the Zeta, which is Oz, right? That completes...
Sure.
The most ubiquitous alphabetic programming out there. So you would be lied to if all there is the Alpha and the Omega. You know, it would be very important to say, you know, to a large amount of people, you don't need to deal with what's beyond there. Just focus on the Alpha and the Omega and everything will be okay. And to a certain extent, that might be true. But if you do cross over into the land of Oz, you get what we're doing here.
Absolutely. I don't want to go into a whole long thing about my experience, but I mean, maybe later if I can, I don't know if I can really even convey it in words, but this is basically the gist of it is that, like, when we say like going to the other side or go, it is the underworld. Like, I was able to see, you know, the other side as all through all these different reality tunnels. I saw the horrific, like looking into hell, looking into death, and, you know, the utter terrifying, rotting nightmare of that view of it. Or you can look at it as this beautiful chance to start over, or this beautiful safe haven, or whatever it might be. And so even going to this other side, but it's like, as we've said many times, like if you took the paranoia out of marijuana, we've said like making marijuana where you didn't have the paranoia, but I think we can take this to a bigger conversation, but it's like, do we just walk around with fingers in our ears saying there's not a damn thing in room 237, or is it like sort of like you have to face it and hopefully you overcome it? You know, overcoming it shouldn't mean, you know, that it breaks you and you end up going crazy and killing everybody. But going to, you know, being able to face that and be strong in the face of it, I think is so necessary.
Have you seen that movie Stalker by Tarkovsky?
No.
Yeah.
That's room 237, right? That's where he takes the people on their journey to the room in the nuclear wasteland. And the room is where you get your deepest, most desired wish to come true. The only thing is most people don't really know what that wish is until the room hits them with it. And some people don't make it back because they can't handle that kind of truth. But I think it's a fascinating movie. The tone of it is incredible, but I think it's definitely applicable to this conversation. So highly recommended.
Well, actually I would say that everything that he's done is very Kubrickian, and that his films all meet. He's like weaving his films, so like especially like Solaris with that. Like,
yeah, uh-huh.
It should be like, it's not just that one turns you on to the next; it's that they actually are connectors. You know, just genius. And then to watch him, and then watch Lars von Trier, who's so influenced by him, is really you kind of get it. You know, it's really cool. But
in 1984, they keep talking about like Room 101, right? Now, what I've thought for a long time, the idea of 101 is the twin pillars with the sacred feminine inside, right?
Totally.
Right. So it's like, here you are going back into the womb. This is time travel. It's weird because it's like, it's time travel. It's the land of the dead. It's the other side. It's back into the womb. It's all these things.
Wow, I didn't ever realize that. Like, you're talking about the High Priestess, right?
Absolutely, I'm talking about the High Priestess.
And then I was like, why was I just thinking the same thing and being like, oh, that doesn't really work? In relationship, I said Planet of the Apes, and we're talking about the Forbidden Zone.
Absolutely.
And then it was occurring to me that what is in the Forbidden Zone, but Isis broken down, right?
Yes.
Ah,
exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So, you know, when to go into that room 101 is to go into this room where he says, he finally finds at the end, what is in room 101? He says, you've always known what's in room 101. It's your biggest fear. You know, it's the thing you fear most in this world. Well, is it the thing you fear most, or is it the thing that liberates you? And it's like, well, sometimes the truth is scary. Sometimes it's all of these things at once. Justin Morgan and this guy, Thomas Malone, used to do a podcast called Grok the Talk. It was amazing to me that this guy on Grok the Talk and Justin Morgan on two separate occasions told me the exact same experience they had about confronting this Kali-like monstrous, you know, woman in the bathtub from room 237, this horrible thing. And then the minute they stopped being afraid of her, she turned into this like beautiful angelic figure. And it's like, what do you want? It's the sort of the opposite of room 237, where the beautiful woman turns into the nightmare. It's like you sort of have a choice. So it's like when you go in there, is it the thing you desire most, as Bill was saying, or is it the thing you fear the most, as Orwell was saying? And in a weird sort of way, are they not both the same thing?
Right.
If you want the truth, you're going to get the full truth. And Jack Nicholson can't handle the truth.
Right. We all know that because he ordered the Code Red Room. Okay, so... I'm sorry. I didn't get enough sleep last night. I apologize. I've been dealing with my mental state recently. But so I'm considering that just how interesting it is that you have Joachim and Boaz is literally established in strength, which are the two pillars, right? So you have established in Oz. You have it when you lay out the letters using the European system, they all add to 777 with the lightning flash. And then to say that...
Did you say when you add the letters of Joachim and Boaz, it adds to 777?
No. When you add up the letters that are the pathways...
That I know. I thought you were telling me something else.
I'm just realizing right now that it never really struck me until yesterday, actually, that how interesting it is where strength lands. Because if it's between Chesed and Gevura, that's the 72 and the 216. You have its exodus. That's where the firmament splits. That is the point of the tree where you have a split from the supernal triad to the seven lower spheros. And so the significance of that being the splitting of the Red Sea is where you derive the 72 triplets to make the 216. And then to have that be the split that's between Chesed and Gevura, the severity and the mercy, it's just, and then that, of course, that's, we call that strength, and then that's Oz. It's literally that Oz is being established out of the split, which is the very thing that they say about the tower. Is that the tower comes out of the name, literally, because the name is the tree when you go through and you're like, when you look at the four worlds that make up the tree. And so I'm just realizing that it's out of the split of the worlds that you have this thing emerging that is our city. And so I don't know, I was like, it's just too perfect.
Is the 72 into 216 the manifestation of 72 in three dimensions?
Well, what's okay? So, I'm going to read this. So the name composes into 72 triplets by taking the first letter of the first verse, the last letter of the second verse, and the first letter of the third verse, and the next triplet consists of the second letter of the first verse, the second to the last of the letter, so of the verse, and the second letter of the third verse. It does a thing where it goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, which is basically like, so you have one go, the first name goes one way, the first triplet goes one way, the second goes in reverse, and then the third goes the way that the first one went. And so you literally have two sides splitting and the one in the middle going in an opposite direction. Which
so is it going like A, Z, B, Y, C, X, something like that?
See if it was actually an alphabet, but these are actually verses that are composed of different letters.
But I'm I meant conceptually though. Is it like working a little way in from either side, working towards the center?
Kind of hard to show without actually writing it out. So, but yeah, conceptually you got it. So, in a sense, what you're saying, Bill, you could take, I've been taking it that literally when we're looking at the Red Sea splitting, we're looking at the scroll opening. And as you're crossing the Red Sea, you're literally reading down the page, which isn't a page in this case, it's a scroll. And so being crushed by the Red Sea would literally be being crushed by the two pillars that are holding the scroll. When you open up the scroll, literally unrolling these two pillars, right?
Okay.
So that literally the center of it, so you're literally, that is the tree. And it's like, and this the skin of the serpent is literally like what you're reading, which is an illusion. And so you don't want to get caught up in the Torah, which is what they tell you, you know, well, a good teacher will tell you that you want to transcend the Torah, you know, and the only way beyond is through, just like life. And so that's what you're doing when you're tilling the soil to get at the tree of life. The soil that you're tilling, like we said before, is, you know, is the words, which is really interesting too, if you consider like the idea of Thoth as the inventor of language, the one who weighs your heart at the time of death against the weight of a feather. Is the language bringer, right? Like that's, you know, you're being judged basically on interpretation in a sense, you know, because you're interpreting have I not, you know, I have not killed, I have not stolen, I have not, what it's how identified you are with your physical form, the dense side of your form, because that determines the weight. Kind of interesting. Of course, that's Egyptian, but so it's sorry. Probably upset somebody with that, but it's okay.
That was a lot right there.
Yeah, it is a lot. And so then when you think about, you know, that literally that the four stands before Metatron as the Ot, which is the other tree. So you also have this idea that the other tree, that the split in the tree of life is what's allowing the tree of knowledge to emerge, right? If everything was connected, there would be no, and the tree of knowledge is literally taken as infinite recursion. And so this is why I was like considering like Blavatsky's idea that she had that issue with the folks who were doing the spirit conjuring, communication with the dead. And this ties in very well with the idea of the Ark as a transmitter, but like a way to communicate with the other side. When she's looking at these people talking to spirits, and she was like, you know what, I don't think you're actually talking to spirits. I think but there's something very real to this, is that when people die, that there's like this recursion thing that just like basically like when the energy gets let go, what energy isn't flowing in the individual is like locked up in like a loop, and that loop still exists in matter. And so when you think you're talking to a spirit, you might be talking to this like replaying energy that is playing out as if it were like a personality or an identity, but it's not, it's just something that's hasn't been freed up. So it's kind of like, and then that's an interesting interpretation of like purgatory. You know, it's just like energy that's just locked up in the material that hasn't been allowed to rejoin the river, so to speak. So I don't know. And then that's really interesting that it's all, you know, like you look at Ema, Bina as like the collection of the waters that are the rivers from Chochmah. And the fact that it's all water ties in so nicely with everything that was getting thrown around last week involving water portals. You know, you have like Stargate, water portal, Donnie Darko, water portal, Contact, water portal, you know, and even if you consider that 2001 A Space Odyssey, when watched with Pink Floyd Echoes, the lyrics are all water-based. You're in an ocean, you know, like they can't escape this like water symbolism when it comes to wormholes. You know, it's a big can of wormholes we're opening up here.
Well, think about the fact that so like, obviously, there's this equivalency between the archetype of being on the water or being in space, right? It's like the celestial waters is a very common metaphor, yes? So, like, you have a ship that goes on the sea, or you have a spaceship. But ultimately, it's still, like, essentially traveling on water, yes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, here, as I was watching 2001 last night, I kept thinking, like, one of the angles in which I wanted to look at it was as, like, obviously, it's 2001 A Space Odyssey. How does this relate to Odysseus? Like, Odysseus's journey upon the sea, right? So here, when we see, David, you're the one who pointed out that when David's trapped outside, it says Mem is on the screen as he's saying, open the pod bay doors, Hal.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Water.
And yeah. So obviously, right, it's the hanged man, but it's also water. So he's like basically been cast overboard, you know, in this respect. There's also what I couldn't help but think of was, you know, the idea that it's Saturn, like say like a Mark LeClaire has viewed this as like being hellish or satanic, but Saturn is also like the land of the dead. Like I never saw as clearly and never experienced as fully that Dave Bowman is going to a land of the dead, which in the actual Odyssey, there is a scene. It's called a Nakuya. It's actually a sort of story trope that has the heroes descent into the underworld. And he has to like go to this island and open up this doorway and go into the underworld and before he can continue his journey. And it made me wonder if part of the movie isn't just like focusing in on that aspect of it. Now, obviously, there's a lot more to the movie, but I never experienced as fully that was him going to a land of the dead. Now, when you say, Blavatsky says, yes, you're talking to spirits, but they might not be literal spirits, is exactly the thing that I kind of bounced around with. Because one could see it as we've talked about, Chris Meyer says the TV was invented by a guy who's trying to use a mirror to contact spirits, and he gets the idea to make a television. Then we have like something like Poltergeist, where the spirits actually come through the television. You have something like 2001, which is saying, go through the Stargate, which is the movie screen. So it's saying, do you want to go to the other side? Do you want? But what would be the other side? Is it this land? Is it like you know, a heavenly, beautiful other side, or is it this, you know, dark land of the dead? I mean, you can go through and see either of those. And what Kubrick is doing is showing you that this is one of the ways you can experience that. It's basically a horror story of like, this is how what you could experience. And ultimately, that you can't go into – this is the biggest thing that I've been struggling with, is that you can't go into this existence if you're going to go into time, because Saturn is not just death, but he's time. So Dave Bowman is traveling on the sea of time. First, he's traveling on the sea of space. Then he's traveling on the sea of time, and that's why he's aging and being reborn. This is another aspect of Saturn, but – it's the only that if you're going to play with time, not only do things grow in time, but things age and die and rot in time. So it's like, of course, you know, you can have the moment and enjoy the moment, I think would be to come out of this experience and hopefully realize that, but also to realize that the very act of you having the moment, that you're bringing all of history and civilization and everything with you. If you're manifesting a world, you're manifesting a world with genocide and with, you know, sweatshops and all these different things. So yes, it's going to be like the spirits of the dead on which this is grown from. Even like Donnie Darko, we were talking about, right? The land he goes to, essentially everyone there is dead. You know, this is, so it all depends how literally you want to take it. Is it that you're contacting spirits, or is it that you're just traveling to the other side? This is the other side of the curtain. And in a weird sort of way, they're all true in their own sense.
Yeah. I mean, this is like, this is a idea that's really kind of scary, like that we've been...
It's terrifying. Come on. Yeah, it's fucking terrifying.
In the commentary I've been looking at recently with my teacher, it's really kind of scary. If you take it seriously, ends up getting presented, because I wasn't realizing for the last years what was actually certain parts are actually driving at, and I didn't catch that they're literally saying that our perception is being influenced by these like mechanical outside forces, so that they're like parasitic, so that they like work their way into this like substratum, and then they just like attach themselves into like the perceptual mechanism. And so like that's fucking weird. Like, that's crazy. And so I actually watched 2001: A Space Odyssey yesterday, but just the final sequence with Pink Floyd, to show it to my friend Andreas, because he had never seen it. And I was like, what, you never seen that? Fuck, dude, we gotta watch that.
Hey, about what time was it that you were watching that?
Probably around 6 p.m., I think.
Okay. And you're three. So, oh, because the movie started at 7:30. So, if how long is the movie? It's like just about 2 hours.
142 minutes.
140. Okay. Of course. So, that's it was not... around, yeah, but it was pretty close at the same time.
Yeah. That's funny. I was considering this whole thing, like, I can't, like, after reading that really great article, I keep, I don't know who did it, maybe it was a group of people, but that contributed to it, but the flipping throughout that movie, that, like...
I think that's 2001: A False Flag Odyssey.
Yes.
I think that's that guy's site.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I did notice it, like, it was something else I kept my eye out for. And I was able to notice, you know, have you guys seen 2001 on the big screen?
Yes.
Yes.
Bill? Oh, okay, cool. So my experience, this is the first time I saw it on the big screen, and my experience was kind of what you were saying about The Shining, how you can see the Playgirl magazine, how you can see the Red Book. Like, the whole, like, German flag on the satellite, like, that was obvious. Mm-hmm. It was there. Like, very clearly there.
Yeah.
Like, something else that maybe people have realized this before, but you know, so you see the German flag. We see, we later see the American flag inside the meeting room, but in between the German flag and the American flag, there's, you know, that dome that opens up?
Yeah.
Right? His shuttle's landing, and you see that dome opening. Oh, Jesus Christ. Sorry. It's got surprised or something. That dome opening is the Union Jack.
What do you mean?
Picture the British flag.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see what you're saying.
And now picture that overhead view of the dome opening.
Yeah.
I got it. Yeah.
So he's showing you, like, the German flag, the British flag, the American flag. Like, this is, like, in a weird sort of way, he's touching on... you know, government but like full Western collaboration. I'm sorry, I lost that. But just to say that these things that these things were noticeable. Like obviously the Union Jack thing is a bit of like my reading into it, but I'm saying like just the details that were more obvious in watching it this time. And yes, the flipping of those scenes where he has the three sweeping pods on one side and the two sweeping pods on the other, and then it keeps flipping back and forth.
Comes through an impossible opening. Like when he leaves the ship in the final sequence, he's opening up a pod and going through a door that there shouldn't be a pod in, because that was Frank's pod.
Right.
And so you're like, well, am I looking at a reverse of the ship? So like that's the idea, I guess, is that you're looking at most of that movie in reverse. You're looking at them flipped, and that so that you could go either way with it depending on how you want to view it. So that when he sketches the guys in hibernation from Planet of the Apes, and he's sketching them out, and you see that the that he's drawing them one way and they're actually appearing another. So they're flipped. So either they're in unreality or what he's drawn is an unreality. But I'd prefer to take it that what he's drawing is a reality, because when he goes to Hal and he's showing them the drawings, what do you know? He skips the drawing that they show him drawing where they're shown the way they actually are, which seems strategic, right? Because it's like he's showing them all and he's like, these are very nice renderings, Dave. You know, oh, you've improved, you know, or whatever. And it's like, you can kind of take it that he's like, it's like the Predator. It's like, so everything he's showing to Hal, he's also showing to the management of the mission, which have their own agenda, right? And so he's the eyes of those higher-ups. Like, they're watching everything that they're up to. Like, it's all about surveillance. That's what that movie's about. But he doesn't want Hal to know that he sees the way things actually are. Frank is the one who, when he's playing chess and Hal beats him through cheating, Hal straight up cheats, he tells him what the move was and skips ahead, making Frank think that he has no option, because he's like, oh, knight to king four, or whatever it is. And Frank just concedes, and he's like, oh, okay, like, doesn't question it. And so, of course, Frank dies, and then David Bowman transcends, or, you know, goes across the abyss.